So, the race to the end. Ignorance. We got to ignorance. So I hope ignorance, as I just explained it, or as I explained in the morning, deprecating or exaggerating, over-exaggerating, under-exaggerating, that I think makes sense. Just another way to clarify it. Oh, it's not? Okay. I probably have to put this up a little bit. No? Oh, that's great. Great, thank you. But then there's another type, or there's another two types, called innate, and the other one is, the other word is intellectually acquired. Now that's, again, a weird word. It's not a very good word, but I think if we just explain it, it becomes clear. Innate misperceptions. They're innate wrong views that we're born with. So from a Buddhist perspective, we've had them since beginning this time. We've had them all the time. They were just always with us. I like the word instinctive. Not everyone likes the word instinctive so much, but it's almost like no one needs to teach us that. We were born, we have it. So these innate, or if you want, instinctive wrong views, there's so many of them. So one, of course, a favorite one is this innate sense, I live forever. I will live forever. So this, I live my life according to that. It's like, yeah, intellectually I know, oh, I'm going to die one day. But innately, I have a sense, it's not going to be tomorrow. It's not going to be the day after tomorrow. Oh, it's not going to be in a long time, and possibly never ever. So I live my life in a sense as if I was going to live forever. I mean, even as a nun, I do that. I mean, it's just a matter of, well, repeated remembrance that it could happen any day. But it's hard to do. So I get carried away and I forget. And so instinctively I feel I'm going to live forever. It ties into the other wrong perception that perceives myself to be permanent. I think I'm permanent. I have a sense I'm permanent. I know I change intellectually again. But this is where the head and the heart don't meet. And when I say the heart, I mean it's kind of weird. But actually the Tibetan word for mind can also mean heart. So it's actually not that far away. Anyway, when we talk about subtle mind, it also becomes a little clearer where the heart plays a part in mind. But anyway, the point is I hold phenomena to be permanent. Whenever there's a strong emotion, check your mind. There's a sense it will last. When I get sick, why am I depressed when I get sick? It's just for a day. But somehow there's a sense it's going to be forever. Right? If I was more aware, oh, it's passing. Just as I'm here, it's already getting better. But that's not the sense I have. So with everything, there's a sense of like being more permanent, more lasting, more concrete than it actually is. And especially in the sense of like not thinking of death. And our society is great for that misperception. It makes sure that we don't ever see death. I mean, it's not on the TV, only the bad news. It's not part of the media, not part of the advertisement and so forth. So it's kind of shoved to the back, so we're not reminded. It's bad news. So like a glamorous magazine, I mean, you'd find something about birth, but definitely not about death. And actually death, I mean, we have this sense that death is something finite. But actually, birth is also a death. Birth is the death of something that was before. And death is birth of something that is to come. So they're pretty equal. It's just where we focus on. If we focus on in terms of birth, we focus on the coming together. We don't actually think about the end of that which was before. Right? And life in the womb. I got what Rita sent me. I got something. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe we could be put on the Dharma.
I translated it into English, so maybe I can translate
it. Yeah, I may send it out. This is really beautiful. Anyway, I won't give it away. Rita's got something about womb and stuff and past and future lives. That's very beautiful. Anyway, but the point is, it's the birth is the end of something else, is the death of something else. If there is past lives, anyway. Think about it, like if there's a 50% chance that there were lives before, then our birth in this lifetime is the death of that which was before, right? the death in this lifetime is the birth of something else. So it's both a birth and death. But we don't see it in that way. We only see one side of it and see it as something finite. Every moment, in fact, is a moment, a death of one thing and the birth of something else. Every morning, every night we go to sleep, it's actually very similar. The process of going to sleep and the process of dying physically is quite similar in terms of the mind. I mean, on a certain level, when it comes to the subtle energy winds, very similar. So every night we die, every morning we're born, in a sense. So there's the death of, last night it was the death of the 25th of November. This morning it was the birth of the 26th of November. Tonight's the death of the 26th of November, and the birth then, you know, and so on. Anyway, so a different way of looking at it, because it's just not as dark as it is. It's just a matter of perspective. However, there will be the last day of my life, and I don't know when that is, and I don't take that into consideration instinctively. Instinctively, you'll be surprised, even in societies that accept the law of cause and effect, Tibetans, it's part of their life. Instinctively, they still feel, well, if something happens, then everyone else blames everyone else. Right? It's like something happens. Really, whatever happens to us, we have some responsibility. It's actions in the past that we've accumulated, that's the result. The result are experienced. So, if I'm aware of that, when something horrible happens to me, I don't feel like an innocent, or I don't feel like a helpless victim. I don't feel like helpless because, well, if I don't want that for me to happen again, I can change it, right? I can change things. I make some change in the future. So whatever happens to me, there's also external circumstances that are responsible. However, I play a part in that. So I find that very empowering, right? It's like I'm not totally exposed. I'm not totally ausliefern. What's the German, the English word for ausliefern? Ausgeliefert. Yeah. Yeah, exposed. Okay. Helpless kind of. Yeah. Oh, this is great. So many people understand. Okay. Okay, anyway, so it gives me that kind of, you know, strength to do something. But anyway, the point is, nevertheless, even though I believe in past and future lives, I have this instinctive sense, blame everyone else. Tibetans do the same thing. Indians do the same thing. That's their culture, to believe in the law of karma, in the law of, well, in past and future lives. And still, instinctively, it doesn't seem that way. Of course, innately, of course, we also have the sense of an inherently, intrinsically existent self. I mean, the most famous kind of misperception. So we have all these innate senses of this, that, and the other. And they all come down to that innate sense of ignorance, actually. It all comes down to that. So if you learn more about it, it makes sense that if you perceive phenomena to be concrete and objective, you also perceive them to be permanent. It's the expression, one is the expression of the other. If we concretize, if we hold on to things and we draw fixed lines around them, we need to also perceive them to be permanent. It just happens naturally. Anyway, but that is only the innate one. Then there's the intellectually acquired, which actually, I don't like the word intellectually, I don't like the word acquired, and so it's not a word I really like, but what else could I call it? But if I describe it, it's views that one of their causes are instinctive wrong views, and then these instinctive wrong views have led us to build, to have philosophical, religious, scientific, and cultural views and beliefs that are, we're not born with them, but we've developed over time. Right? So they're based on the view that I'm permanent, for example. They're based on the view that I exist inherently, or other people exist inherently. They're based on that, but then on top of that, we add more to it. So examples for that are, for example, well, I've given an example of a view that people held at the time of the Buddha, 2,600 years ago. As I told you this morning, there was a lot of emphasis on finding what is the self, what is the I. You know, what is it actually? So there was a philosophical view that explained that the I is permanent, the I or the soul is permanent, partless, and independent of mind and body. It was actually a whole school that asserted that. So that was an intellectually, it was a philosophical view that people held. Nowadays we have those views too. For example, a soul. I think I've talked about this last year. I grew up thinking that the soul was in a heart shape, was heart-shaped, and when my grandmother died, it had little wings, and it flew out of my grandmother's mouth into heaven. Right? That was my view of soul. That's how I grew up. So that was my view of, that's my grandmother. That's the self of my grandmother, the soul, the essence of her. That's a view that's not, I wasn't born with that view. I was educated. I saw pictures of that, and slowly my grandmother probably told me about it, and so therefore I had this view. Then there's the Austrian psychoanalyst who talked about the ego and the superego. Right? So there you have a view that's been cultured of, there's like an ego plus a superego. Two kinds of kind of independent egos. Also, there's cultural ideas of be someone in the world. Find yourself. Go find yourself. Be yourself. Be who you are. And it's so funny, we have these funny ideas about the self. Like, again, this is something I mentioned during the talks last year. When we have a sense, I'm just not myself today. What does it actually mean? I'm not myself today. It's like, who am I actually? I mean, it's the mind and body, they are who they are, right? The body is the body, the mind is the mind, but I'm not myself. So it's like something totally separate there, that it's just not oneself. And I think that a lot. I'm just not myself today. And I think, oh, well, what am I thinking here? It comes a lot. It's just this sense, oh, I'm just not myself. But that's, again, that's that sense, it's culturally kind of fostered. That idea is culturally fostered. And it is the result of the innate wrong perception of the self or the intellectually acquired or both. Does that make sense? So these are all examples, yes, so intellectually, philosophically, these views have been fostered, and they're therefore not innate, but intellectually acquired, but based on the innate view. Then there's other views, of course. For example, the intellectually acquired view that there's no past and future lives. Based on the scientific idea, well, that our body, our mind is the same as the brain, it's just chemical reactions, and when they change, when they stop, the mind stops. So from a Buddhist perspective, saying that brain and mind are exactly the same, then of course if that is the case, hypothetically, past and future life couldn't exist because when the brain rots, the mind rots. Sorry for my language. But, you know, when one stops, the other one stops. Right? One disintegrates, the other one disintegrates. So all that can happen when we die is we stop existing. Okay? The mind slowly disintegrates. Actually, that's the other banality. It's like when we die, that's the end of conscious. So if the brain and the mind were the same, the brain, as long as the brain is there, the mind would have to continue existing. The mind would slowly go out of existence as the brain goes slowly out of existence. But that's where science and logic kind of, that's where it goes, you know, the moment our brain, you know, doesn't function anymore, then the mind is gone and the brain slowly disintegrates. The mind and brain are the same. Right? It's actually not possible that mind and brain are the same, even from a scientific point of view. But nevertheless, these are scientific views that are intellectually acquired. We're not born with them. We learn about them and we then take them on. And therefore, the view that there are no past and future lives, the intellectually acquired one is an example that I just gave. Right? The view that mind and brain are the same. And of course, the religious believe in an omnipresent God that is responsible for all our problems. Also intellectually acquired. I mean, Buddhists don't say that there's no God. There's God, but there's no omnipotent, creator of all our problems God. That is not accepted. Okay. And then the next explanation I gave here in this reading, so this basically completes the two types of misperceptions of reality. The one that is innate, instinctive, and the other one that arises from that. And then, of course, and only here did I actually explain the root of all other afflictive emotions, of all wrong views, of all the ones I described now. The actual root of that is the ignorance or the misperception that perceives the I and all phenomena other than the eye to exist inherently. Okay, so anyway, I've mentioned it again and again, and if you read about it, I think to some degree it becomes clear. I mean, more explanation is needed, but if you have some sense of how this is the root of everything, then of course it also makes sense that we need to develop a view of emptiness, of how phenomena really exist. And so this root ignorance, therefore, brings forth, and this is now where the explanation goes back to the mind and mental factors. I just kind of took off for a moment. I went into just delusions, what they are, and then explained ignorance, which comes down to understanding that the root of all delusions is this ignorance or this misperception of reality in its, on its deepest level. And then I basically went into now, of the 51 mental factors, the six primary delusions and the 20, I still have to, I cannot, after all these years, it's 20, it's not 21, yeah. The 20 secondary delusions, okay. Six primary delusions, I'm sure all of us are aware of them. And this division into six, it actually comes from Vasubandhu and from Asanga, those two half-brothers who lived in India, well, more than 1,000 years ago, almost 2,000 years ago. So those two brothers, they basically gave these divisions. And of course there's other ways of dividing it, but there's a sense that there are six delusions that are more grave, that are six afflictive emotions that are responsible for the other ones. But these are the gravest one. These are the strongest, the heaviest ones. And there's a list of those six: attachment, anger, arrogance, ignorance, afflictive doubt, and wrong view. Here, the ignorance that is meant here is actually not the type of misperception, act of misperception. It merely refers to, according to Asanga and Vasubandhu, the people who kind of made this division, who wrote it down for the first time, according to them, it was just a sense of not knowing, of just a non-knowing, not understanding, having this kind of haziness, like not knowing how to write, not knowing how to read, not knowing about certain things, which is different to misperceiving something actively. Does that make sense? This is why this is mentioned here as number four, and then number six, you have wrong view. It's almost like, if we think of the ignorance here as number four, isn't that a wrong view either? But as I said, more specifically, the reason why this is as number four, the ignorance, is that Asanga and Vasubandhu meant the one that's more like hazy, just not understanding. Okay, just if you have that kind of doubt. But anyway, then it is explained then later on when Lama Tsongkhapa and other great masters explained, for example, the ignorance, they just explained it the way we know it. Okay, but there's something more to those six primary delusions. The last one, wrong view, is then again subdivided. So there's lots of different wrong views. Okay, so we have already discussed lots of different wrong views, but it's just again, we move around the mountains trying to get a different perspective. Look at it in a different way again. Be more specific about what kind of wrong views are there. And some of them we recognize, definitely. Okay, so attachment, anger, arrogance, ignorance, doubt. These are described as the five non-views. They're more emotional. They're more emotional. So remember I talked about this, I think yesterday, about some afflictive states, they're more emotional. Anger. It holds, it's a wrong consciousness as such, but just superimposing the bad quality, negative quality of another person. So remember, anger is a mind that focuses, let's say, on another person, or more specifically on a characteristic that the other person has, and then either exaggerates it or makes it up. Right? It was not there in the first place. Okay? Either it totally makes it up, it superimposes it, or it doesn't add, it doesn't superimpose in the sense that it puts something there that wasn't there, but it exaggerates it. So these are the two possibilities. But that itself is not anger. That's not anger. Just doing that is not anger. It's the wish to harm then. It goes together with those two. So we talk a little bit about this in a moment, about how the anger actually arises. What are all the steps in between? And before we have anger, we exaggerate the qualities, the negativities, and then anger sets in. So there's actually this kind of gradual process. So anger is really a wishful mind. It's like, want to harm. Right? So it's not a view as such. It's not this kind of rational mind. It's an emotion. I want to do this. I want to do harm. I want to kick them. I want to do this. I want to, whatever I want to do. Likewise, attachment. Right? I want to have. Exaggerating the positive qualities, that itself is not attachment. First we exaggerate what's there, the other person, and then want to have. Want to have for myself. Right? Don't want to be separated from. That's attachment. Okay, again, like an emotional state. But if you look through all of them, arrogance, ignorance, afflictive doubt, they're kind of emotional states. Here is the ignorance of just not knowing. It's not so much wishing something, but it's just kind of being in the dark about it. So that's why it's still part of the non-views. But then wrong view is like a rational mind. It functions in the same way as a correct rational mind, except it is irrational because its object is just not existent. So then you have five of them. This is why the six primary delusions are also sometimes explained as 10 delusions, where the sixth primary delusion is again subdivided. Okay, so five non-views and five views. Okay, attachment. I have explained it in such so much before, so there's not much need in going into all its details. But I thought maybe what would be interesting for you is how we get to attachment. How does it actually get there? And it's so hard to put every step in between. And of course, every attachment is unique. Your attachment is unique. Everyone's attachment is unique. I mean, we are unique. So why we're unique? Because our mind is unique. So our positive states of mind, our negative ones, they're also unique. Every moment, in a sense, is unique. However, there's some regularity to it. So attachment exaggerates, it superimposes. And it comes from a mind that also superimposes. It starts with perceiving myself to exist. I add something. You know, I exist, of course. I do exist. You exist. But the way I exist, I kind of add something there. You know, I is that which I call the summary, or on the basis of this mind and body, I say I. But honestly, to me, it feels there's something separate from my body and mind. Which explains why, when I say I walk, I'm not just thinking my legs walk, and therefore I say I walk. I have a sense that miraculously my eyes being picked up when I walk. Not just my legs do that, but also my eyes being picked up. So there's a sense of something separate. There's a sense that something separate, and because there's something separate, I have to protect that. That thing that is separate. There's something there. And since it's not this as you and I are different, and not just conventionally, but inherently different, right? Intrinsically, totally, objectively, there's you and there's me. There's a strong divide now. Okay, I'm on this side, I'm on the good side, so you're sorry on the bad side. So if it's your happiness as opposed to mine, oh, it'd be mine. Sorry. If it's not my happiness that's to be sacrificed, all right, I can work for your happiness. Especially if I get something back. But if it's of the two, honestly, I mean, when it comes down to it, it'll be mine. And that is so deeply ingrained. Not to be underestimated. When it comes down to, like, fighting for my life, I'll fight for my life and not for anyone else's. It's so deeply ingrained. Okay? So we shouldn't underestimate it. But the point is to recognize this first. That's the way it is. And therefore, if then I have the sense I, and you're there, in a very strong strong and pronounced way, therefore my happiness is more important. And everything that is for my happiness is weight. It's according to me. If it gives me happiness, it is good. If it doesn't, it is not. Very, very straightforward in that sense. And so just as if I have a sense of an inherently existent I, something inherent there, there's an inherent other. And if that provides me with happiness, I look what it is that provides me with happiness, that quality. And again, that I perceive to be objective. It's over there, inherently. And then I blow it up. I only focus on that. The more I'm interested in it, the more I want it, the bigger I make it. And then I want it, and I can't be without it. You see how we just add and add and add, right? Keep adding, adding, adding. Okay? So that's how attachment arises. That just constant concretizing or solidifying, putting more there than there actually is. So, the verse says the ignorance apprehending the inherently existent. So let's say there's attachment to a car. I don't know why I chose a car, but never mind, it's a car here. It's not that serious. It's more the attachment to another person that creates more problems. People don't kill so much over cars, but over attachment to other people. So, inherently existent car, the inherently existent positive qualities of the car. Right? There's also that apprehension of the inherently existent positive qualities or of the other person. Those misperceptions induce, it's not that straightforward, actually. Of course, these misperceptions also induce other wrong views, such as the wrong view that this inherently existent person with his or her inherently existent qualities is permanent, is lasting, right? And I have a sense, this is lasting. He or she's always like that. He or she will always be like that, and they always provide me with happiness. That's why I need it so badly, right? And then on top of that, he or she is in the nature of happiness. They can provide me with happiness. Another wrong view that arises. So you see, it's very complicated. That's why it's not easy to get rid of attachment, because there's so many causes and conditions coming together, making it so complicated. Okay, so unless we recognize that, it's very hard to overcome it. So the perception that they're permanent, the perception that they're in the nature of happiness, the perception they exist inherently. So we need to see all of those to be wrong to be actually able to do something. So it's not easy. Never mind, it's not impossible. It's just a matter of taking the time and looking and recognizing that these views are not in accordance with reality. And then naturally we can, the attachment will lessen naturally. Can't any other way, because you're not fooled by it anymore. The wrong views, if we're not fooled by the wrong views anymore, it's very difficult to have attachment. It's a slow process. It's really just a little bit less. It kind of comes naturally, eventually. Anyway, but the point is understanding how we get there in the first place. Understanding, making that connection between the ignorance and attachment. Because if we don't, we don't want to know about emptiness. Or we want to know because it's fun, but we never really practice it to the degree that we really meditate and really make it part of our own life. Try and every now and then remind ourselves that phenomena do not exist inherently. And of course, attachment is worse than anger. Attachment is worse than anger because anger everyone recognizes as being negative, first of all. Secondly, it comes strongly and it goes away strongly. Attachment is very creepy. Creeps in slowly, and then it stays, and it seems it provides the wrong promise that it benefits us. It's like something that benefits us because it gives happiness to me. Okay, it doesn't seem destructive. It seems to be very positive, and it's like, of course, I'm sure many of you know the example. It's like oil that seeps into a piece of cloth, very hard to remove. Slowly creeps in, it fuses with the cloth. And it stays. I mean, all of you, I'm sure, know about how difficult it is to remove an oily stain. So it's similar to that creepiness. And of course, attachment is actually also the root of anger. That's why in the Theravadan tradition, sometimes the root of anger, the root of all delusions, the emphasis not on ignorance, though they do speak of ignorance, the emphasis on attachment, which is really after ignorance, it's attachment. After a perception that the I exists inherently, attachment to the self arises. That's it. Right away. Okay, anyway. So understanding that difference and being aware of attachment. Again, where is my attachment? Where is my main attachment? And if we start to hate our own attachment, we start suppressing it. Not a good idea. Pressure cooker effect. Without, you know, the valve. Very dangerous. An Indian pressure cooker where the valve doesn't function. Right, in India it happens sometimes, they explode. So, very difficult to suppress it, but to just recognize it for what it is. Start recognizing it, and then understand it's working. And not, you know, just work with the attachment, either via working with the causes, reflecting on impermanence, for example. If we really think about impermanence, that the other person is not permanent, that whoever we attach to, they're changing moment by moment. And we eventually will separate from them. If we just have that view, you will see naturally we're able to let go a little. Let go a little bit more, a little more, and so forth. And so as Vinavarita today pointed out during the meditation, Buddhism is really not so much about gaining this, gaining that, because we're superimposed the whole day already. But it's about letting go, letting go, letting go. Letting go of these views, especially the views that superimpose, seeing that that adding that we do all the time is just an adding that's not based on reality. And then slowly we let go, we let go. An attachment, we can slowly let go. Okay. Anyway, but first step, of course, recognizing it. What are its causes? And not recognizing it here, being able to write about it yourself, maybe in Hebrew, we can explain it beautifully. But look inside and say, oh, all right, this was, okay, this. Then I perceived it to be permanent. Then I perceived it to be in the, you know, like just with a relationship, when we're infatuated with someone, okay? How our mind makes us these promises. Oh, he or she's like this, he or she's like that. We never even check. We don't want to check because we may be disappointed. Right? We have this view, they're like George Clooney or like, I don't know, who else is there? Angelina Jolie or, you know. And then we want that so much because we want to have someone like that, so we don't check. We're just fooled by these qualities. And then slowly attachment arises, becomes stronger, stronger, and we're trapped. So to check in every moment, try as much as we can. And again, I said no excuses, even an 8-hour job. And however many kids you have, you can do it right in that moment, with the kids actually. Attachment for children, so interesting when you brought it up, it's so true, right? But again, it's the sense there's only this life. There's only this. They're my children forever. Okay? But then when we take it a little further, it's scary first. I'm sure it is. No, it's not easy with children. I think it's the hardest with children. I'm not a good pastor to talk about it, actually. I'm always fascinated by the love that parents have for their children. And there is pure love there, too. It's mixed. There's the attachment and there's the pure love. The pure love is terribly inspiring. But the attachment is terribly painful. Oh, yeah, I know from my mom. She always cries at the airport. She's the only person that gets... Pardon?
Let's accept that it's painful.
Well, I mean, if you want to have the pain, sure. I mean, sure. I mean, you know, if you like to. No, I'm not saying you should. It's your own choice. But it just makes your life and your children's life probably easier. I mean, the stronger the attachment from the parents, it's hard for the children too. Trust me, I mean, it's sometimes difficult. It's a lot of guilt. Oh, leaving again for India. Right? My mom is the only person that gets past the security at the airport. Still now. She gets through the security to say goodbye one more time on the other side. She gives me the cross every time. Lets me go. Right? I mean, no, I'm kidding. But I mean, it's, and for my mom, I mean, if she has to, I mean, there's so much pain there. And my mom hates the pain. Trust me, she does. She doesn't like it, but she can't deal with it in any other way. Pardon?
She meditates?
No. No, she's not a Buddhist, no. Anyway, I'm not saying it's just up to you. It's up to you, of course. This is just if you don't want to have that pain, there's a way out of it, right?
No.
Do you have children?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, anyway, it's not part of this discussion here, but I think what he brings up is healthy. I mean, I'm not saying...
It's not extreme.
No, I'm fine, I still have, thank you. No.
It's not extreme.
It's not extreme?
No, I mean, you can't say, don't be attacked.
No, that's what I'm saying. No one says this. That's the pressure cooker. That's the Indian pressure cooker system. Don't be attached. That's impossible. But you can look, well, first of all, if you like your attachment, fine. Good. I mean, you know, if you like it, no problem. It's like, you know, if you have, I don't know, some rush and you like it, you don't go to the doctor. I like my rush, right? I like that scratching and the redness. It's pretty kind of, you know, goes well with my robes. So, okay. I mean, but if I want to get rid of it, I find a cure. Right, I look at what's the cause for it. Do I really want this? Does this bother me? Would it be better if I didn't have it? Right? Still having skin, still having love for my children, but plus the painful aspect. You know, and that's everyone's choice. As Venerable Rita said, It's our freedom. The Buddha just, there's a cure for certain problems. Do you like them? Well, see and find the cure. If you don't, well, continue on and good luck. Right? I mean, that's the whole point. Like, we have the freedom to choose. So in this case too, but don't suppress it. Don't judge it. Just look at what are the causes, and then we can naturally actually deal with understanding the misperceptions. And so this is what this is in here. So like how they get here. So it's not just about the anger, but trying to understand where it came from. So anyway, you could read this. I don't want to go into this. There's not enough time. Arrogance. Similarly, all of us have arrogance, right? If I'm with the Tibetan, I've been with the Tibetans, right? And I've learned to be humble. But it's just pretense. Because I'm so arrogant that I don't want people to think I'm not humble. So, it's like a way of being humble. I mean, humility is something different. Humility actually comes from deep inside. Okay, so just what is at the outside, we can't trust. So I know myself better than anyone else, and I know my arrogance. And so therefore, when I'm like kind of, it's just another kind of arrogance. I'm thinking I'm a little bit more important. That's arrogance. Just my qualities are a little bit more. Okay, that's just one of the other like primary delusions. And again, recognizing it is the first step. Understanding it's working and catching it before it kind of takes over my day. Okay. Then there's different arrogances. I just got those from Vasubandhu's text. No need to go into them. If you read them, I think they're very straightforward. Ignorance, I've said plenty about that, just because that's number four. It's in here too. Lama Tsongkhapa says it's mainly the ignorance that refers to the law of karma and so forth, law of cause and effect, but never mind, it includes actually any ignorance, if you like. Afflictive doubt, we've discussed. Right? A kind of wavering doubt all the time. And there's a Tibetan saying that two-pointedness is really, if we have that two-pointed mind all the time, that kind of deluded two-pointed mind, never being able to make a decision, right? Oh, is it this? Is it that? Can never decide. This is like sawing with a two-pointed needle. Has everyone ever tried to saw with a two-pointed needle? Right? A needle that's two-pointed? Right? We never get to get anything straightforward done. So likewise, with that mind, always undecisive. That's similar. Does it need to be translated into Hebrew? Sawing with a two-pointed needle? No. Okay. So we cannot accomplish our own... The ladies should explain here. Two-pointed needle. At least the ones that do a lot of stitching. Anyway, I'm not good at stitching. I had someone actually explain that to me, a Tibetan. Two-pointed needle. Anyway, so we can never accomplish our own goal if we're like this, that the whole time. So now, the five views. The view of the transitory collection. View of the transitory. It's just the view of holding onto an inherently existent I. The transitory. Transitory means impermanent. Collection means the collection of the five aggregates, body and mind. The things that make up the I. That is impermanent. And so collection, different minds, different parts of the body, and that is perishable, that is transitory, changes every moment. And perceiving an I on the basis of those is the view of the transitory collection, like a separate kind of I. That is the view of the separate of the transitory collection. The view of holding to extremes is the view that because of thinking the I is permanent, there's only two possibilities. Either I hold that the self exists forever. Because if there's such an inherent I, the next step would then to perceive the I to exist forever, right? Or, when I die, to be totally non-existent. Because if it existed inherently, it could either just be always there without changing, or when it went out of existence, like, if it really would change, like, in one moment, it would become totally non-existent. So either that's the view of extremes, resulting from the view that there's an inherent I. Either it's always there or it's never there. Okay. Then there's the belief in the supremacy of wrong views. I like that one. Because we have wrong views and we feel really good about those wrong views. Oh, when I first came to Dharamsala, I decided I will not believe in past and future lives. Because everyone did it. And I was kind of like this kind of rebelling kind of, rebellious kind of mind. Oh, everyone does it, and now I want to do the opposite. So for a long time, I was really proud of not believing in past and future lives because everyone else did. I was kind of special. That was a belief in the supremacy of my wrong views, right? And there are lots of examples like that. Oh, I hold this view, even though it's a wrong view. Of course, we don't think it is, but you know, I have a view. I have an attitude, right? That I have a view. So that's another wrong view. And there's the belief. Okay, so this one, it's very dangerous, especially in the 21st century. Believe in the supremacy of mistaken ethics and religious conduct. Okay? So it actually just refers to believing that certain religious practices, bring salvation, bring happiness, where actually they harm us. So I'm sure there's different religions. I mean, even the Buddhist religion, people hold wrong views that actually harm them. Okay, following someone who's not a highly qualified person and believing this person to be a high lama and they should just do anything for them. That's harmful and it's painful when we find out that we've relied on the wrong person. That's why His Holiness the Dalai Lama always stresses, check for as long as you need whether the person you're relying on really has good qualities. Okay, so to not be, not go into a wrong direction, to be asked to do practices that have nothing to do with Buddhism. There are practices like that. I mean, there are, especially when it comes to tantra. Ooh, you know, anything is possible suddenly. So that's a big problem. So that would be a belief in the supremacy of mistaken ethics or mistaken conduct. I gave an example of, in Christianity, the mortification of the flesh. It's not really that something that people do nowadays. I don't know. But I don't know. I saw some documentary, and this is where I was reminded, you know, people beating themselves and believing this gives them... Right, gives them, and this is not the same as prostrations, because that seems to be the same thing. You know, it's like, oh, self-mortification. Let's just really sweat it out and do 100,000 prostrations. But here again, it's not the prostrations themselves. It's the mental state, visualizing that one purifies negativities, and because the mental consciousness is so powerful, we can actually purify our mental consciousness in such a way. So we clean it up because we have that intention and we work hard for it in the sense like these prostrations are a way of like working for it too and opening ourselves to something higher than oneself. So I mean, that's kind of the idea. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama during one of the teachings recently said, if we don't prostrate, like a prostration, and again I mentioned that this morning, but a prostration is not a prostration if you think about something else. It's not actually a prostration. It's just the outside. It's a bit like a on the movie set, you know, like the house that's not a house, right? It just looks like a house from the outside. It's like that. So to be an actual house, it needs something internal, and that's what the motivation is. And then if you just do it internally, that's actually the prostration. But here, there are certain practices that seem to be mortification. So like nune, for example, right? But it's not this is not like a, oh, if I just don't eat, I become enlightened. That's not the point of that. I mean, I'm sure you know about newness or the importance of that. It's the motivation. It's like going through hardships for the benefit of others. Okay, so it's totally different. So, okay, newness, I don't know whether Venerable Rita would be much better to explain the purpose and how they're done. But anyway, if you're interested, she can explain you. But these practices of like fasting for some time, it's also a kind of hardship, but it has a very specific purpose. It's not just not eating, and that's the end of it. Okay, anyway, so there's lots of practices. In India, where practices such as standing on one leg in the middle of somewhere where it's really hot, and then that was perceived to be a religious practice. I was going to put in, and I didn't put it in, and then I decided to say it nevertheless because of what you said yesterday. Suicide bombers. Suicide bombers. Suicide bombers, yes. People who believe that if they blow themselves up and they kill as many infidels as possible, then they'll be reborn, you know, in heaven. I thought, no, I'm not going to say that because it's in Israel and I don't want the divide to become stronger, right? But then I was reminded of what you said. When you said, with the wrong view, compassion arose. Because, oh my God, if someone is trapped in a wrong view like that, how sad is that? Right? So the suicide bombers, they're totally trapped in these wrong views. And how sad, because they suffer so much more. The suffering they inflict, of course, it's a lifetime of, you know, parents being left behind, children being left behind. But then that's the end. It's one lifetime. For them, it's many, 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 many lifetime of a lot worse suffering. So, I mean, it sounds weird, and it's difficult to say that the perpetrators have compassion with them. But that's why I thought it was so beautiful when you said it, and that's why I thought to mention this. Suicide bombers, too. These wrong views, totally controlled by those. God, what a shock when they die and there's not how many virgins ever, but something else. I mean, really, I mean, it's just a wrong view that, I don't know, I've heard about these virgins that...
And we don't know yet.
There may be the virgins, but that may not be the happiness.
Right, exactly. Maybe they're the guards of hell or whatever. I mean, anyway, never mind. But from a Buddhist perspective... From a Buddhist perspective, well, Buddhist or not Buddhist, if we inflict suffering onto someone, it comes back. The suffering that we give onto someone, it comes back. Because we're interconnected. We're interconnected. I mean, it makes total sense. If I inject my right hand with some poison, my left hand, I always do it wrong. If my right hand injects my left hand with poison, since they're interconnected, it'll come back. It's logic. Isn't it? It's logical. Because of the interconnectedness, whatever I give out, it comes back to me. I mean, pollution of the globe is a very good example. But karma works in the same way. Whatever unhappiness I give out, it comes back to me. Anyway, there's so much more to be said about karma. But wrong views such as those, religiously wrong views, they're usually very much emotional. It creates so much suffering. But most suffering is created for the perpetrator. Anyway, wrong views. So wrong views is the last one. And again, it includes all sorts of wrong views, such as wrong views, not believing in past and future lives and so forth. Never mind. But the ones previously, I thought it was important to mention them. Because if we look what governs our life on a smaller scale, so which one of those do we hold? Okay? Do we have a belief in the supremacy of our own wrong views and so forth? Really, if we check, it'd be a surprising fact, possibly, that there's a lot. We probably recognize ourselves if we're really honest with ourselves. But a lot of the problems in this world come from those. And again, if I want to change something, I need to start here. So the first step, if I want to change the world... No, I need to change here. I mean, I just need to start here. I need to become aware and then make changes. All right. So, the 20 secondary delusions. How much more time do I have?
No.
Pardon? No.
1 hour.
1 more hour, okay. All right. The secondary delusions, I could just read through them, and then we're actually almost done. So again, I'll read through them, and please... Don't listen with this kind of intellectual mind, but when was the last time I had one of those? How many of those do control my life? Okay, we just listen to it with this kind of view. So the 20 secondary delusions, they're called secondary because the other six, they bring forth those secondary ones. Aggression. Aggression, right? Wow. There's a lot of aggression in this country, I think. Yeah, there is. Aggression is a mental factor that is an increase of the primary delusion of anger and that wishes to physically or verbally harm others. Okay. Right? It just wishes. I'm not saying someone is not aggressive if they don't go out and say things. And I sometimes get so angry, it gives me joy to visualize I beat the person up. It's scary. Right? And I allow myself every now and then to just go wild. Sometimes there is someone in the nunnery I live in. And this person presses all my buttons. And I wouldn't dare for that. Of course, I mean, a nun, oh my God, you know, imagine the repercussions of what people say about me. I would never beat her up. But every now and then, whoa, I just visualize, kick her down the stairways, take the pressure cooker lid and go, wing. I mean, that's aggression. Right? I mean, saying doesn't help, but, you know. Anyway, that is aggression. I know, I'm sure we do it every now and then, especially when we're tired, okay, when we work too hard. So it's very important, again, to be rested, to be well rested, okay? And then, especially at times when we're exhausted, we come work home from work, you know, husband, wife hasn't done this and that, children are all over the place, aggression. And our aggression is often directed towards the people we love the most, right? It's not so much the stranger that sells bananas down the street. I mean, you know. No, it's towards the person, well, we love the most. So aggression. When was the last time we at least imagined? I shared with you when was my last time, so when was your last time? When for the last, we wished to physically or verbally harm someone. Okay? That's aggression or belligerence. It's just another word. Resentment. Resentment is not anger. But, you know, it's just this tiny thing. Well, it's a mental factor that maintains the continuum of the primary delusion of anger without forgetting it and wants to retaliate. Right? It's like someone said something, maybe a month ago, and every time I meet them, one day I'll get back at them. I'll definitely get back at them, you know. I won't forget. My memory is quite good, I remember. When was the last time we felt that way, wanting to retaliate? Or when we have an argument with someone? Oh, right, he did this today, but wait next time. I know where it hurts. Right? Again, resentment. Concealment. Concealment is a mental factor that is a type of ignorance which wants to conceal one's faults from others when they're pointed out by someone with the motivation to benefit. I mean, oftentimes, and this is Israel, people are straightforward. It's actually great. I mean, really, honestly, it's not like, you're so nice. You know, I mean, this is what I find difficult with the Tibetans sometimes. They never tell you to the face. So you just don't know. You need to learn to read their expressions. And I'm not good at that. I'm not trained in that way. So I find that hard. I like the Tibetan way, the Israeli way. People always say, oh, don't you, Israelis say, like, don't you think it's really rude? Yeah, it is, but I like that refreshing bit because I trust people just tell me anyway, so I don't need to read everyone all the time. Just tell me, I can relax. In the Tibetan society, you have to read people a lot. Yeah, and if I was born there, it'd be easy. But here, I can just relax, just wait for people to tell me. So that's good. But, I mean, then, of course, if it's with a point of motivation to benefit, and still, you know, if it's something, oh, I'm really terribly proud about, then I conceal it, of course. Okay? So there's concealment. So that's a negative mental factor. So oftentimes people tell you something with a motivation to actually benefit you, but it just, in that moment, we try to conceal it. That's actually a negative one, right? And it stops us from growing. We're unable to grow. How can we change if we don't allow other people to point out our mistakes, if we're in denial about them? Spite. Spite is a mental factor that is a type of anger which, motivated by the secondary delusions of aggression and resentment, wants to speak harshly. Again, right? Before we say something with a harsh voice, well, that's the one that precedes anything. Oh, you suck. Balagan. Is that a word? Yeah, they say that a lot, right? But that's not a bad word. That means mess, doesn't it? Yeah, okay. So, you know, there's other words, I'm sure. You know, you suck in Hebrew or something. Whatever that is. I haven't learned that one yet. Rega. Is it rega or rega? In Tibetan, it's shut up. Shut up. This is, means shut up. Here it means wait. Shut up. Okay.
So,
go to hell. Oh, okay. Interesting. Anyway. So spite is a mental factor, all right. So it's that which motivates us to speak harshly. Jealousy. It's not a major one, but it's still 21st century fosters jealousy. Right? Tibetans don't have much jealousy, but it's interesting now because the other extreme is being not ambitious enough. And so the school kids are not ambitious enough. So the Tibetans are just developing a system to become more jealous. More competitive. They have the system now. Who's the person who's number 1, 2, 3? Number 3 goes towards the front first, and everyone claps, and they get presents. And then number 2, and then number 1. So it fosters that jealousy. Whereas with the American students I teach in Dharamsala, number 1 and number 2, number 3, they're secret little notes. that we have to give them. No one knows what how everyone else has done because they're so jealous. It's become the other extreme. So it's like the competitiveness. It's competitiveness, but also jealousy. If someone else does better than them, they can't bear it, and therefore it's totally secret. Right? It's tiny pieces of paper that only they can read, and their grades are on, and no one shares with the other. It's the same in Israel. It's the same in German. Numbers. Yeah, roll numbers. Tibetans just trying to foster that competitiveness. And they're not terribly succeeding. I mean, because it's just that the Tibetans don't have that much. Jealousy is not really part of their culture. There is jealousy, there is, but not to the degree that it's fostered in the West. Okay. Or has been fostered, and now people try to deal with it. Miserliness. Okay. So we know what. Jealousy is a mental factor. There's a type of anger which, motivated by attachment to material possessions, status, etc., cannot bear and feels resentful towards others' accomplishments. So that's jealousy. So it's kind of resentment, motivated by attachment. Miserliness. Miserliness is a mental factor that is a type of attachment which, motivated by attachment to material possessions, status, etc., holds onto things tightly and does not want to separate from them. And I'm not just talking about material things. Miserliness with time. Not having the time to listen to our friends, not having the time, to listen. Yeah, well, listen and share with them. So these days, time is money. So time, being miserly with one's own time, that's also a type of miserliness. Being miserly with one's ability to help, not providing that help. Pretension. Or deceit. Pretension is a mental factor that is a type of ignorance. Again, don't forget. Is this a mental factor that I have or not? To be self-reflective while I go through them, please. Pretension or deceit is a mental factor that is a type of ignorance or attachment which, motivated by attachment to material possessions, status, etc., wants to pretend that one possesses qualities one does not possess. Okay. Happens all the time. Pretending one is a little better than one is. Sometimes we're not even aware we're pretending. That's the scarier bit. We're totally in denial about ourselves. Dissimulation. Dissimulation is a mental factor that is a type of ignorance or attachment which, motivated by attachment. So attachment goes, when I say motivated by attachment, it itself is either an attachment or an ignorance, but a previous moment of attachment induced it. So attachment to material possessions, etc., does not want others to know one's shortcomings, to hide our negativities, to not tell anyone about it, out of attachment. Haughtiness. So haughtiness is not arrogance as such. It's a little bit less than arrogance, but still this kind of afflictive kind of self-confidence. Haughtiness. Yeah, he just did the movement of the head. That's it. It's a little bit less than arrogance. Arrogance is being really full of yourself. This is like an exaggerated sense of self-confidence. It's like arrogance is just stronger, right? So it's hard to, I don't know, in Hebrew I'm sure you have, yeah, that one. Everyone seems to agree, so. Haughtiness is a mental factor that is a type of attachment which, having taken to mind one's accomplishments and good qualities, generates an afflictive sense of self-confidence. So it's being a little bit better somehow. Not like, okay, I'm totally arrogant, but a little better. Right? Okay. Shamelessness. Okay, so non-shame is the same as before. So Venerable Rita called it integrity or non-integrity here in this context. So that's another translation of the word, shamelessness. So it's a mental factor that is a type of ignorance, attachment, anger or attachment, which is devoid of a sense of shame with regard to one's negative actions. Right? I mean, a sense of like just oneself, whatever. I mean, people don't see me? Okay, I can just, well, it's gone. But they can take the cookie from the altar. Inconsideration or non-embarrassment. Inconsideration is a mental factor that is a type of ignorance, anger, or attachment, which is devoid of consideration for other sentient beings with regard to one's negative actions. All right, we've done that before. Dullness. Okay? It's just being dull, just kind of a laziness, whatever. Don't want to meditate. The movie is much better. Dullness is a mental factor that is a type of ignorance which makes the mind lethargic so that it's unable to comprehend its object. Is it lethargic or lethargic? lethargic. So that it's unable to comprehend its object clearly. Just that kind of allowing the mind to become really drowsy and not applying any antidote. Excitement. And here it's a negative type of excitement, an afflictive excitement. It's a mental factor that is a type of attachment which scatters the mind that is unable to remain focused on an object. Right? Just letting it, all right, let's just scatter around and be distracted. Non-faith. Non-faith is a mental factor that is a type of ignorance which does not believe in, does not have admiration for, and does not aspire to virtuous phenomena. We had that non-faith before, right? Laziness is a mental factor that is a type of ignorance which, due to attachment to sleep, etc., dislikes or feels sluggish about engaging in virtue. It's not just attachment to sleep, because there's also a laziness of defeatism. I can't do it. I'm helpless. It's a type of laziness. It's like lacking that. It's a strong afflictive emotion, and it's very hard to really explain where it comes from. It's lots of wrong views we have about ourselves. But low self-esteem is such a huge problem nowadays. But low self-esteem comes from an exaggerated self of an I, right? Exaggerated sense of I, because I cannot fail. My best friend fails. Oh, never mind. It doesn't matter, right? If my best friend fails, it's bearable. But my best friend is not as important as I am. Therefore, I cannot fail. She can. He can. Does that make sense? So we cannot forgive our own failure because somehow we think we have to. And this is what Renata Rita expressed so beautifully, this idea of having the courage to be useless, to fail, right? To not always be the best and be number one. It's okay if I fail. Having that courage of being a failure in that sense. Okay? So first to just let go of this, like, I have to succeed always. And this low self-confidence we have, or the low self-esteem, comes from the sense, I need to succeed. And if I don't, I'm bad. We never do that. We're never as harsh with other people than we are with ourselves. Oftentimes, we're more cruel with ourselves than with others. Because it seems really contradictory, but there's a sense that I'm a little bit more important. Does that kind of make sense? And that's not saying we are bad people. It's just there's a wrong view that governs us to such a degree that our own failure becomes impossible, becomes unbearable. And so we start hating ourselves. Right? And we think, I can't do anything. And it's almost like we get attached to that. We get attached to our own low self-esteem. That's who I am. I'm worthless. And we get it, we almost like, it's like we hold on to that. I remember times, definitely before, when I was like a teenager. Oh, I'm just going to kill myself one day because I'm so horrible. I almost enjoyed doing that. I'm going to kill myself one day. I'm so useless. It sounds pretty sad, but I was almost like delving in that, right? That was me. At least I was someone. It sounds stupid, but there was this weird contradiction in my mind, right? I can't do it. I'm a failure anyway. I am. Okay? So I can't do it. It's a type of laziness. Whereas understanding, I can do anything. You can do anything. It's just the mind that makes us feel we can't. We can do anything. We have this incredible mind already. Right? As Venerable Rita said, in its natural state. Actually, the Buddhas are sane and we're insane. Right? It's like the Buddhas who've reached enlightenment, well, they're the ones who have used their natural state in the most natural way. Okay? And we're the ones who can't use that. And therefore, not being able to do that, we create all these ideas about ourselves. They're only mind-made. And we believe in them. We're so accustomed to believing them. It's so hard to let go. We're so attached to them. But it's just, we can do anything. There's nothing that any of you cannot do. Doesn't mean right away, but we can work towards it and slowly get there. If the causes and conditions come together, there's no way you will not get the result. So it's a kind of laziness. It's described as a kind of laziness. Oh, I can't do it. I can't do this. I can't do that. It's not true. There's not a single person. It's not a single person that has set out to do the Dharma, has really done it, who has not changed. Sometimes drastically. I met people that were real jerks, and a year later they were totally transformed. because they did all the, you know, the causes and conditions that brought them together. And even maybe they were kicking and screaming, they didn't want to change, but they did change. Right? I mean, to the good, actually. So it's the mind as such, it's impermanent. If things come together, it changes. Anyway, so therefore, diligence is counteract, or the opposite of diligence is, or sorry, what was it? Laziness. Oh yeah, laziness. So laziness, the kind of laziness that is not just the laziness of sloth and procrastinating all the time, it's also defeatism. Big problem. Not thinking that I cannot do it, or I can do it in my next lifetime. Keep procrastinating. All right, non-conscientiousness. Non-conscientiousness is a mental factor that manifests together with one of the three poisons, anger, attachment, and ignorance, and with laziness, and that leaves the mind in a relaxed state without habituating it to virtue and protecting it from contaminated phenomena. So this is like a relaxed state that is not virtuous. That's kind of like, oh, let's just relax all the time. It's too much relaxation. Again, relaxation is important, but only when it's necessary. After I've rested, I don't need to relax. Then I can go and work again. Forgetfulness. Forgetfulness is a mental factor that is blurred with respect to virtuous objects due to remembering non-virtuous objects. Right? When I forget my objective, and I say, I wanted to be really kind and compassionate today, and I set out really well, and then the attachment came in, and I allowed the attachment to just, go forth. The anger. Let's just have the anger its way. Let it just go. And then I forget what I set out to do. That's the kind of forgetfulness that's a problem here. Non-alertness or non-introspection. Maybe it's also non-vigilance. Vigilance. Venerable Vita talked about vigilance today, so maybe this could be non-vigilance. I'm not sure how it could be translated. But non-alertness is a mental factor that is a type of afflictive wisdom which is not alert with respect to physical, verbal, and mental actions. Right? Just not being alert. Let's let it go. Let's just think and do whatever we want without actually being alert. Distraction. Distraction is the mental factor that is a type of anger, attachment, or ignorance which is distracted. All right. So these are the 20 secondary delusions. Again, in order to really understand our delusions, it's vital to go through them every now and then and see which is the one I need to work on the most. Where do I mean, to overcome all of them right away, impossible. There's nothing right away. That's impossible. But we could maybe pick one and go, oh, that one that one is the most pronounced one. Let's see, how can I lessen that? How did it arise? What are its antidotes? And then applying them. Okay. And then the last mental factors are the four changeable mental factors. Sleep, regret, general investigation, and detailed analysis. So these can be positive, negative, they can be virtuous, non-virtuous, or neutral. That's why they're said to be changeable. So sleep. Sleep is a mental factor that is the result of mental heaviness or mental dullness and functions to dissolve the sense consciousnesses into the subtler mind. It can be positive, because if it's before I fall asleep, I have a positive state of mind, then it actually transforms into something positive. And sleep, what happens at the time of sleep, is very similar to what happens when we die. And if just before I die, I have a positive state of mind, I make that last moment, when the coarser mind absorbs into subtler minds, I make that positive. So this is extremely important from a Buddhist perspective, to keep a virtuous mind, especially when we pass away. And if there's no someone else, and in Israel, I believe that there's great emphasis on taking care of your family members, more than in Germany. And so taking care of the elderly, I mean, I'm sure that there's room for improvement. However, there's more emphasis on looking after your parents, possibly. And so then make sure that they are comfortable as possible, and so that when they pass away, they have peace of mind, there's a virtuous state of mind, and then their death becomes something virtuous, and the future, whatever the future holds, holds something positive. Yeah. So from a Buddhist perspective, if we die with a virtuous state of mind, we're more likely to have a positive rebirth, and then more opportunities, of course, and more freedoms in the future. So also before we fall asleep, these 8 hours of sleep, we can transform them into something more positive if just before we fall asleep, generate a positive mind. So we can make a negative or positive, either of those. But sleep here means like this state or this mental function of dissolving the coarser minds, and we'll discuss this in a moment, into the subtler ones. That's called this at the time when we don't die, but when we do it for just falling asleep. That can be positive or negative or neutral. And then there's regret. Regret is a mental factor that feels remorse for physical, verbal, or mental actions done in the past. That can be positive if I regret having done something positive. It can be negative if I regret having done something positive. Oh, I shouldn't, you know, I shouldn't have spent so much time and helped them. That was a mistake. I wasted my time or something. Or, you know, whatever. I shouldn't have been generous with them. That was a waste of money. Or I shouldn't have done whatever I've done. So that's negative kind of regret. Whereas positive, of course, I shouldn't have gotten angry and so forth. General investigation. Investigation is a mental factor that roughly examines the general nature of an object. So I want to rob a bank. I generally investigate the bank because I want to rob it. Okay? Or I want to hurt this other person. How can I hurt them? What is ineffective? What can I say to really hurt them? So a general investigation of that would be a negative general investigation, whereas a more detailed analysis would be, how can I really hurt them? What are the things that really hurt them? I mean, just an example for something negative, or how can I rob the bank? And then positive one is, of course, how can I benefit myself and others? Investigating it coarsely or more in a detailed fashion. All right, that concludes the explanation of main mind and mental factors. So I know it's been tedious, it's been a lot of mental factors, but we only had little time actually, but again, as I've stressed and as Rita has been stressing too, we need to continue on with this. We really want to make some change. We're very interested in this path. To study the mind is one of the foundations, and there are lots of good books available. And so, at least maybe if you've learned about this time, there's already some impressions, some residue, some imprints. And every next time you hear about it, it's a little easier. Okay, so you have this reading material, which will eventually be translated into Hebrew. But of course, there are some amazing books out. I mean, Geshe Teshe Tsering, Geshe Rabdin. What is it called, the book by Geshe Rabdin? Mind and its Functions. Yes, so Mind and its Functions. So if we could put that on the website, like a book, the readings, then people, you know, can take it from there. So now the last category is the category of subtle and coarse minds. Okay? So this is actually so important, but unfortunately there isn't that much time, but I'll try and finish it. So this is saying that right now we use only coarse minds. We use sense consciousnesses and we use coarse conceptual minds. They're very coarse. Delusions, all our delusions, they're very coarse minds. But we have very subtle minds. We have subtler minds, what we call subconscious now. I don't know how to call it, but there's minds that are more subtle. And then there's the very subtle mind. So there's usually division into gross or coarse minds, subtle and very subtle. So the coarse minds, the ones I mentioned, the subtle ones are the ones, for example, when we go to sleep. Okay, at the time when we sleep, there's mind, there's awareness at all times. So the sense consciousnesses are all coarse. But the moment subtler minds arise, the sense consciousnesses disappear. They dissolve into the subtler minds. And then the mind can even become subtler. Okay, and the subtlest mind is called the clear light mind. That is the mind that resides in the heart. Well, not in the heart, really. In the center of the chest. There's a small vacuole, and it's said to reside there. It's located there. And this, it's an interesting, because in so many cultures, when someone points at the eye, they point at the heart. I. And so many emotions associated with the heart. So I guess there's a sense that there is something there. It's kind of become part of our culture also to point in that direction, unless you're Japanese and you say I. Watashi. But other, yeah, it's very often it's the heart. Anyway, It's the explanation that's given in Tantra, for example. You can read about this. It's just about the mind being dependent on subtle energy in our body. So every mind goes along with the subtle energy. So the mind actually is dependent on physical objects, except that these physical objects, especially with the subtlest mind, when we die, the subtle energy wind moves out with the mind. So it's like even the body disintegrate, the subtle energy wind and the subtle mind, they continue on. They leave the body. And these subtle energy winds, I think they explain to me, for example, when you come to a place where people practice a lot of meditation, then the place changes. Because the subtle energy of the body has an influence with the outside. I, for myself, I feel that this place is very special. My mind is very different here than in Tel Aviv. Because the energy is different. Because people's minds, every time we think something, we feel something, the energy is also affected. And the energy goes in and out through the breath. It's actually our breath that the energy is revived. There's an exchange happening. And that's why certain places, the whole place changes. I took Gengetsula when he was in Germany. Some of you know the story. When he was to Germany, we took him to a concentration camp. Bergen-Belsen. And I'd forgotten, it was such a stressful thing, I'd forgotten to explain to him where we go. I'd forgotten. So we just got there, and Genla was like, "What is this place? This is horrible. Can we please leave? I don't want to be here." And I was like, "Genla, I'm sorry, I totally forgot to tell you. This is a concentration camp." Of course, then he wanted to stay. I mean, he wanted to hear and he wanted to see it. But yeah, it was like we actually didn't just go there. We went all over, went to museums and castles and so forth, and also to the concentration camp. But that I'd forgotten to tell him about. And he was like, "Oh my God, this place gives me the creeps." So it explains that you know, a place such as a concentration camp where so much hatred and so much suffering, it had an influence even on the place. And Dharamsala, I mean, I believe Dharamsala is so special because of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and these other great lamas. I mean, so many people come there and they say, "Oh, I'm so happy and relaxed." Right away, they feel that, right? Yeah? There's something about the place. And sometimes when someone is really angry, you come into that room and you can feel it. Sometimes you can feel it. You can pick up on that energy. So that explains that. Every thought we think, it creates an energy and it creates something in the environment around us. How amazing! Isn't that beautiful? We can make our home a really happy place by just thinking positive thoughts. And there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a documentary called Water Energy that talks about we can actually change the structure of water. We don't change H2O and don't make it into H3O or something. I don't know if that's possible, but anyway, but we change the structure, and that explains why in a lot of religions the water is blessed. Anyway, there's a whole documentary on that which I thought was very interesting. So it's like we are not separate from the external. We may feel that way, but what we think has an effect on the environment, on other people around us. And that's beautiful, because you want to make a change actually just having positive thoughts while we're in the traffic jam. Right? Maybe we'd be caught in a traffic jam when you drive back. Have positive thoughts. It can actually have a benefit. You know, it can have an effect, and people may not notice it, but who cares? Right? Make your car really special or whatever. Anyway, so, I mean, these things, I mean, they seem minor, but we can feel it. We can go to places and feel that darkness. And with Genla, if I had told him, all right, then he would have already conceptualized, "Oh, this must be a dark place." But since I hadn't told him, and he had felt it on his own, I believe there was really something from the side of the place because of what had happened in the past. Okay, so such is the power of the mind. And so the subtle mind, so the coarser minds, they're also dependent on energy winds, but most important is the subtle minds. And the subtle minds we cannot utilize right now. We cannot utilize them. When we fall asleep, we fall unconscious. Unless you're a lucid dreamer. People who have lucid dreams, well, they can possibly control their dreams and then, you know, do something with their dreams and affect them. And this is very much part of some of the Buddhist practices, especially tantric practices, but only on a very advanced level, because if you don't know what you're doing, you just go mad, unfortunately. And I met someone, a German man in Dharamsala. He did practices that messed around with the mind and he became crazy. So that's why tantra is secret. Tantra is usually, it's supposed to be secret, and there's not much information given away, because it's like the nuclear weapon of, or the nuclear power of Buddhism. Very effective, but if mistreated or not done well, can be very dangerous. Okay? Anyway, but tantra really deals with utilizing the subtler minds. It's not a different philosophy. It's just a technique of utilizing different states of mind. Okay? But nevertheless, the point is that eventually all of us will start utilizing the subtler level of our mind. Right? Eventually, well, the idea is that everyone will do this. And the subtlest mind, that's the natural mind that Venerable Rita basically talked about. I mean, basically it's that mind. That is our most essential mind. And if we can utilize that, then there won't be any delusions. There won't be any anger. However, first we need to deal with the coarse mind and start controlling it and lessen those delusions, because otherwise we can never dig deeper, right? So, I mean, even if it's tantric practice, it becomes totally useless. So the sutric path, the one that we explained before, that all deals with generating more space in the mind and to make the mind ready for more advanced practices. If someone does the advanced practices before one is ready, either it's dangerous or totally useless. But if you get this point, so that there are coarser minds and subtler minds. The coarser minds are active when we are awake. The subtler minds while we're asleep or while we're fainting or during certain states of meditation, tantric meditations. And the subtlest mind, that arises when we die. So at the time of death, what happens when we go to sleep? The coarser minds dissolve into subtler minds. But it never becomes as subtle. It never really goes down to the level of the subtlest mind. It stays at a pretty subtle level. And then when it's time to wake up, the subtler levels, they stop being active and the coarser ones arise again. When we die, it goes deeper. The coarser levels all absorb, even the medium, kind of the middling coarse, subtle levels, they dissolve into the subtlest mind. They all dissolve inside the subtlest mind. And then the little vacuole in which the mind resides, it opens and it leaves that center. It leaves the body, and where the karmic winds, the karmic imprints that are left on that subtle mind, wherever they take us, we go, we're reborn. We enter a fertilized egg ovum. And then the mind becomes coarser again as the body grows, and when the brain is ready, the coarse mind manifests again. And then next life, we're born, have to learn to eat and smell and to eat and walk again, and kind of next circle of life. Okay, so this is really coarse and subtler minds, and it's been explained in here with the different energy winds. I don't want to go into those. There's one last thing I would like to share with you. One last thing that is really important. So, it says here, it's on the last page, the above presentation of the different categories of the mind is given from the point of view of manifest consciousnesses. So, consciousnesses that are manifestly there, actively there. So, when a mind is actively there, it's either conceptual or non-conceptual, direct or indirect, wrong or not wrong. Has mental factors that come along with it, sometimes there's anger, sometimes there's love, and so forth. But there's times when those minds are not manifest. For example, right now, I don't have anger. Surprise, surprise. I don't have anger. So I don't have anger right now. Where's my anger? It lies dormant, right? It lies in a non-manifest state. It lies dormant. And why can my anger arise again? Because right now I have the potential for anger to arise again, which is called the seat of anger. Its seat is a funny word, because if you think of a little tiny brownish thing that's kind of sitting here, that's my anger. But seed has the connotation of a potential. A seed grows into a sprout, for example. So therefore, I have the seed of anger right now, which is just another way of saying the potential for anger to arise again is here with me. Okay? So if I really want to overcome my anger, I also need to get rid of the seed. So I can do a lot of meditation on patience, which allows me, maybe in this lifetime, to totally make my anger non-manifest. That in this lifetime, I will not become angry again. That's possible. But with just the meditation on patience, I can do that, which is very, I mean, that's amazing if I could do that. It would give me so much space and would enable me so much more to practice more efficiently. However, the seeds of that anger, only the mind that realizes emptiness directly can totally overcome. Okay, so it's good to understand that we do these, we work with our anger by applying temporary meditations such as the meditation on patience, for example. And we need that, because if we have strong anger, forget about realizing emptiness, just dealing with the strongest anger. But understanding we cannot stop there, because the moment we discontinue those meditations, eventually anger will arise again. Therefore, we eventually need to cut the anger, eliminate the anger irreversibly, which means also relieve, also overcome the potential for anger to arise again. So that is very important to understand that different states of mind, they don't have to be there, they lie dormant right now, but the potential for them to arise are there. So the same applies for love and compassion. If we have love and compassion for other people developed through meditation, we don't need to worry if it's not there right now, because the potential for them to arise is there. Okay, we just need to remind ourselves and it comes up again. So in the positive or negative way, minds can lie dormant. But if they lie dormant, the stronger they are, they can still have an influence on us. And this is, again, from a dharmic point of view, very, very important. Very important. If you generate great love and compassion, especially if you generate bodhicitta as opposed to egocitta. I like that. I never heard that before. I like that expression, egocitta as opposed to bodhicitta. So bodhicitta, the mind that wants to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings, that is so concerned for others, such deep concern and love, and that we would do anything, we'd dedicate our entire life to go through all the hardships to become enlightened. What an amazing emotion, right? Isn't it just amazing? I mean, the people who are controlled by love and compassion, by bodhicitta, these are the special people. I mean, people we consider special are those. Right, because it's so amazing in that endeavor. But even though these people, when they don't have bodhicitta, when it's not actively there, when it's not manifest, when it just lies dormant, that bodhicitta still influences all their actions. So powerful. And the same is true for very strong anger, of course. Right? When that lies dormant, even that can still, even the anger is not active, the person is still kind of grumpy and weird. Okay? So such is the mind, such is the power of the mind, the mental consciousness. Here we're talking about mental consciousness. Sense consciousnesses, they're always there the whole time, and only when we fall asleep they lie dormant, and they're not big deal actually, they're not really important. It's the mental consciousness, the really strong positive or really strong negative ones. They can have an incredible effect on us. And this explains why for a bodhisattva, as opposed to a here, like someone who's on the Hinayana path, both have the mind that realizes emptiness directly. Both have that. But one overcomes only the afflictive obstructions, whereas the other one overcomes both the afflictive and the cognitive obstructions. It's like one is the fuel for the cable car all the way to enlightenment, and the other one isn't. Okay? How is that? How does the mind... You see, when you realize emptiness directly, you cannot have bodhicitta at the same time. When you realize emptiness directly, your mind is just absorbed into the perception of reality. You will not have bodhicitta at that time. No other mind can arise. You're so absorbed into just the nature of reality. How come that this mind, when it's actively there, can cut through more, overcome more afflictive, more obstructions than the mind in the person of someone who has not bodhicitta? Right, a Mahayana person. It's because even though the bodhicitta lies dormant, it enhances the mind that realizes emptiness. Right? They enhance each other. They can never arise at the same time. For an ordinary person, when you realize emptiness, there's no room for bodhicitta. When you have bodhicitta, there's no room for the mind realizing emptiness, directly, especially. They don't arise at the same time. They cannot arise at the same time. But even though one lies dormant, it can affect the other. The one that's manifest can affect bodhicitta. Like the one, if the mind that realizes emptiness directly is manifest, it enhances bodhicitta, and bodhicitta enhances, they enhance each other. That's why they're called two wings. Two wings can never move synchronically. I mean, if you want to fly properly, I don't think there's any bird that does that. No, they do that, right? What do they do, right? Do they go both? Oh, yes, they do. Oh, my God. Who doesn't? Who does something? Okay, oh, then the bird doesn't work. Forget about what I said. They never move synchronically. When one is up, the other is down. What was I thinking? Oh, that's swimming, actually. Oh, gosh. Oh, wait, forget it. Anyway, you have to... Mm-hmm. Well... No, at this stage, in the beginning stage, bodhicitta, you see, the thing we need to think that first one gets rid of the afflictive obstructions, okay? A bodhisattva gets first rid of the afflictive obstructions because bodhicitta, the strength of bodhicitta is such that it can only overcome the afflictive obstructions, right? And then it's enhanced, further enhanced by the mind that realizes emptiness. Then because it's enhanced, it in turn then enhances the mind that realizes emptiness and strengthens it to such a degree that it can then overcome the cognitive obstructions. Whereas a person who only aims for self-liberation, that strengthening doesn't happen because it doesn't have to. Their mind that realizes emptiness doesn't have to overcome the cognitive obstructions because they become arhats, they become self-liberated even without that. Does that make sense? So, I mean, my example didn't work, but if you think of the idea that... Oh, thank you. Oh, you figured it out. Okay, I'll just add, please just add change course. Don't cross it out. Change course. So when we do this maneuver. Anyway, I mean... Pardon? Oh, yes, that's a good question. At the awakening point, only a Buddha can have incredible love and compassion for a sentient being at the same time realize the ultimate nature of that sentient being. You see, that's what we cannot do at this point. What we cannot do is realize emptiness directly and at the same time have great love and compassion. They don't contradict, but... Well, they don't contradict each other in the sense that we can have both, but simultaneously we cannot have. Because whenever... When we realize the ultimate nature of phenomena directly, we cannot have the appearance of something other than emptiness. And if you have love and compassion, you must have the appearance of a person, for example, their happiness. But when that appears, it's conceptual. Love and compassion are conceptual. They're not direct perceivers, only for a Buddha. They're conceptual minds. They're not directly realizing. It may not feel that way, but if it doesn't feel that way, then I think there's still not a total understanding what conceptual means. Conceptual doesn't mean it's bad. It's great. There are a lot of great conceptual minds. Great bodhicitta. It's conceptual just because you don't experience it as vividly as you would experience the taste of chocolate. But other than that, it's much better than the mind that experiences chocolate. So I'm not putting a conceptual mind down. Not at all. I'm just saying, emotional states, until we are Buddha, they're conceptual. Okay? So this would be something, again, I can only ask you, get a good understanding of what conceptual means, and then try and see, is there a difference between the quality of, like, the eye consciousness, how vivid the objects appear to the eye consciousness, and how slightly less vivid objects appear to compassion and love.
I'm just curious to know whether this fear
that you're expressing is held by all the other traditions. When you mean tradition, do you mean Sakya, Nyingma, Kagyu, or do you mean the Thai tradition, the Sri Lankan tradition, and so forth?
Well, I'm speaking of different ways. I'm not sure.
Same. Same. As far as I understand, conceptual mind, I mean, I didn't study the tradition that much. It's part of the IBD study that we study the different tradition for one semester. But as far as what I understood there, bodhicitta, love, these are conceptual minds. So when we direct perceivers, they're direct perceivers of reality. These are minds that directly perceive reality. And when we directly perceive reality, in that moment, we cannot perceive. I'm not talking about tantric practices. I'm not talking about tantra. This is not part of my job here to talk about tantra. Tantra is different, but I don't even want to go into it. I did my tantric part explaining just the energy winds. But from a sutric point of view, not possible.
So you're expressing
specific. Yes, yes. Lori, this is all from the sutric point of view. Okay? But tantra is not really that there's... It's not saying that bodhicitta is non-conceptual. Not even in tantra. But there's something else, but never mind, I don't want to go into this. Okay, but basically we get this, that even though bodhicitta lies dormant, it can have a great effect. Even though the mind has realized emptiness directly, it can have a great effect. And we know from our own experience, sometimes we get a better understanding of something, okay? And then our love is much stronger the next time. Because even though the love lay dormant, it's affected by that. So it's stronger, it's purer, it's more effortless. And because our love and compassion is more effortless, our understanding grows. Right? So they assist each other. They're like two wings, unfortunately, the ones... Boy, what was I thinking? It was so clear in my mind. I even put in brackets. I looked up this word synchronically. They don't move synchronically. First I said they don't move simultaneously, but I wanted to say they don't move in the same... But what was I thinking? I had this.
No, but what I wanted to say was when one is there, the other one isn't there.
Right? When bodhicitta is there, the mind to realize emptiness isn't there, and vice versa. Nevertheless, so they move synchronically. They can affect each other. That was the point. So this is a very important concept. You may not understand right now how important that is, but it's said that bodhicitta is conjoined with the mind that realizes emptiness. They're conjoined. There's a sense of conjoinment because one enhances the other. So whatever we do, whatever practice of love and compassion we do, it's in the nature that this will enhance our wisdom. Don't underestimate any practice towards compassion, love, generosity. You will somehow have an influence on your understanding and vice versa. That was the last thing I wanted to share with you. This is one of the most important concepts. Again, how compassion, the method and the wisdom, how they affect each other. Even though they may not arise simultaneously. Okay. Whoa. Sorry. I mean, I really raced through this, but at least we finished it. And you have some taste. I feel like I'm in a supermarket and I give you a piece of cheese and then maybe you buy it or not. So if you got some taste for it, you may continue with this. This cannot be the last time. I mean, no surprise that the Tibetans spent 16, 20 years on this. Right? So it takes more time. Anyway, okay.
Each year you come back,
we continue. Oh, okay. Yes, we can do that. Yeah.
Is it all right if we have some short...
Yeah, of course. Of course, please. So I don't have time for questions. Huh? Sorry. So whoever gave me those papers, if you're still interested, I can give you my phone number, or Fred and Maya can give you my phone number. We could still do it over the phone, maybe. Email, I'm a very slow typer. I never get to sit to write down more than two or three sentences, so can't really help you on email. But via phone, we could do it. And otherwise, there's still the challenge to figure it out yourself. Okay, anyway, thank you very much, and then please...